This week on Writers, Inc.
I go from the start of the book and I try to picture the person they are at the start of the story, and I try to picture something at the end of the story that they would never ever do.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So, do you guys know what a tin can phone is?
Yes. I'm using one right now.
It's the two cans with the string, right? And you put it like around the...
No, like the new tech for... So.
Oh, I thought you were talking about my childhood.
That's kind of what this is. So like, I didn't hear, like, I heard about it like I think 6 months ago or something, but it's essentially a dumbed down phone for kids. All it's capable of doing is dialing like either other phones on that particular network, or you can like upgrade your plan and so it can dial actual phone numbers and stuff. But as a parent, you can basically say, you have to tell it what numbers the kid's allowed to call, which is really cool. So yeah. We got one for my daughter. It took like 4 months to get it. Like, they're like crazy back ordered. And my next door neighbor's kids got one too. And I set it up yesterday and plugged it in, and she picked it up and she listened to it. And she's like, "Dada, there's something wrong. It's making a really weird noise." And I was like, what could it be? Like, I listened to it and it's a dial tone. And I realized like at that moment, like my 8-year-old daughter has never heard a dial tone her entire life. She has no idea what that was. And then I had to explain to her, like, that is the sound that we listen for to make sure that the phone is actually working before we dial in a number. And like,
that's pretty
had
cool.
to go through. Yeah. But it's pretty neat. You know, it looks like an old fashioned telephone, and like, it's got a cord on it. So she can now call her friends and they can do little party lines and stuff together.
So is it like VoIP or something? It's not cellular.
Yeah. It's VoIP.
Okay.
It's free if you're just calling like within their network. And then if you wanted to be able to dial anything other than like 911, so your parents' phone number or whatever, it's like $10 a month.
Okay. Per number or per just general?
No, just have access to like that part of the network. Like we've got a safe room here at the house, and like I've been trying to find a way to put a phone in there, and I'm thinking like this might actually be the answer because it's free.
Yeah,
you know, and you can dial whatever you need to from it.
Well, as long as you have internet in there.
As long as you have internet.
Yeah,
but we've got redundant. We've got fiber. We've got satellite on top of that. Our internet's not going down.
Get a ham radio. You gonna put a ham radio in there just in case all the networks go out?
It's not a bad idea.
I've got friends that have that in their like their safe room slash room where they put all their, you know, Armageddon food. And
there are voice over ham technologies too. So you could do a telephone over a ham radio signal.
Yeah. I think I read too many novels, but obviously, you know, if the power grid goes out, all of that is down. Mm-hmm. And like most landlines, like people don't even know, even if you have a landline, most of those have been switched over to like a Wi-Fi. So they still won't even work. So yeah, you got to get the ham radio, talk to other ham radio operators in an apocalypse.
Back in the day, the actual wired telephones didn't need power. Like the power came from a little battery pack down the street from the phone company.
Yeah.
Right. But,
yeah. Anyway, I just thought that was kind of cool.
Oh, the possibilities.
Tell us about your book launch, JD.
Oh, yeah, the book launch. So we're doing, I decided I'm going to do one event to launch the first Scarlet Door. We're going to do it through a bookstore that's just right outside of Chicago. And mainly, like, I picked her because, like, she's selling a ridiculous amount of copies of 4MK. And it's a new store. Like, she's only been open for, like, 6 months, so she's very enthusiastic. Mm-hmm. But, like, you know, I was talking to my agent, and, like, we were going to start lining up the publishers in all the markets where I am and, you know, spend a month traveling around the country and doing all that, which honestly sounds horrible. Like I don't want to, get in a car. Right. I don't want to have to get on planes. I don't want to do all these things. And I started thinking about what I did last year, which was essentially the event on the, you know, on Wood Island. You know, just, we launched it at the, you know, the Haunted House story in the Haunted House. We did one event and that was it. So I think I'm going to, you know, from a marketing standpoint, I'm going to see if that works for the next couple of books. I'm going to do one event, make a lot of noise with it. You know, like we put out a press release that went out nationally. We've got a lot of attention happening with it. But just do the one appearance and see if I can get the same, because I honestly think I can get just as much buzz out of that one appearance as I could from doing a traditional book tour. You know, the only difference is I'm not in front of those 100 or 200 people or whatever at each store. But you know, like this to me just seems more cost effective and better time management. So we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah.
I mean, you're kind of playing with the whole FOMO thing. Like, you know, people are going to make this.
Yeah.
Something that they make a, you know, an effort to get to.
Yeah. I mean, like the original press release, we're holding it at a winery, which typically does weddings and stuff like that, which is a really cool, you know, event space. But the press release, when my assistant put it together, I think he put, you know, like open to the first 1,000 guests or something like that. And then we ran it by the people who are actually organizing. They're like, it only holds 250. So that's it. So our cap is based on the venue. Yeah. But you're right. Like they've already sold a bunch of tickets because people are just, you know, trying to get them before they're gone.
Yeah.
Which is kind of neat. I've got no way of extending it. I guess I could do it, you know, multiple nights if I wanted to do something like that.
That's what I was going to say. You could do, a weekend, like a three night weekend or something, you know?
Yeah. Well, we'll see how it goes. And I don't know what kind of pushback I'm going to get from like other places around the country that want me to show up. Yeah. You know, that, cause there are a lot of people, you know, like to single out one bookstore, you know, like I'm kind of on the fence about that, but at the same time, if I single out a new bookstore every time I do it, you know, just kind of pick somebody who's standing out in the, you know, the crop, then, you know, that might work. So we'll see. It's just another experiment. It's either going to work or I'm going to fall on my face.
Yeah. I think it's going to be fun. I'm excited it's in Chicago because it's not far from me, so I can make it. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, cool. With those two options, it'll work or you're going to fall on your face.
You got to come too. It's not far from you either.
It's not far from me. We're working on it. Right. There may be a complication in our lives that prevents me from going.
You
we'll
complicated,
see.
Kevin? Never.
It's a good complication.
I thought you put the prison time off till next year.
Yeah.
Next year, I signed the deal. Yeah, no. Kara and I are very strongly considering getting a place in Franklin, Tennessee.
Oh, I love Franklin.
So we're kind of any time that we have that, you know, because she's currently training in the role that she's in through November. Mm. So any time that we have that's not, you know, taken up by her having to stay here for that, we want to try to get to Tennessee and look around and, you know, find where we want to be and or decide whether, you know, maybe that's not it, you know, but we really liked Franklin. Ironically, JD, that's where I met you for the first time, and Christine for the first time.
I really like Franklin and East Nashville. Like, it's all awesome. The heat gives me pause because it's humid in the summer, but I really like it there. I was like, oh, that one might be a nice place to retire. But who knows?
They don't get much of a winter either, right? It's pretty mild.
Yeah.
But they do get one and they do have snow, like they have all four seasons, you know, so it's kind of nice. And the terrain is very nice. So, it's very similar actually to where we are here in Pennsylvania. In fact, today, like the temperature and the humidity are identical today between Tennessee and here.
70 and 70.
Yeah. It's like, it's like currently 78 here.
78 so. Humidity. Perfect.
What is going on in the news?
First up, defendants awarded legal fees in Crave copyright suit. A U.S. judge has ordered author Lynn Freeman to pay the legal fees of author Tracy Wolf, her agent and publisher Entangled, after dismissing Freeman's copyright lawsuit over the Crave series. The court found the lawsuit was, quote, objectively unreasonable and said Freeman must reimburse an estimated $3.4 million in legal fees. She must also post a $150,000 bond while pursuing her appeal. The judge said this award should discourage weak copyright claims brought in hopes of a large payout with little financial risk if they fail.
Kudos. You don't want to be the person they use to make an example out of.
No.
Yes.
I've been following this case for so long. That judge was so mad. She was like, this is ridiculous. It should have been... thrown out in 6 months, you know?
I was looking through my notes app and I stumbled across, I had written down the judge saying, hot teenage boys cannot be copyrighted.
How unfortunate. This is, I love this because this is one in a string of frivolous, copyright claims that I've seen over the past 10 years. And they infuriate me every time because it's always something ridiculous. It's always, we're going to copyright hot teenage boys or billionaires or whatever. Like, you
Hot
can't
Girls Read.
copyright
We
these
did that one,
things.
right? Hot Girls Read. Is that what it
Right.
was?
Hot Girls Reading. Yeah. Book
So I love
boyfriend.
seeing this fall flat on its face. I hope that we see actually, I hope we see a lot less of this
I
in the
thought it was
future.
interesting that they're making her post bond to even appeal it. So, like, if she doesn't even put up the money to appeal it, she can't pursue that.
That's an interesting turn. I don't know that I've ever seen that before, but it makes sense because, if she can just endlessly appeal, this thing goes on forever. So there should be some cost to this.
I agree.
So many legal problems could be solved as if like the losing side was responsible for the fees of the winning side. Like people would really give pause before they filed a case. And there are countries where they do that, and they've got very few lawsuits because of it. But the way our current legal system is set up, the attorneys get rewarded no matter what, and they're the ones that are really pushing for this. I can guarantee there's an attorney whispering in her ear right now she could win that appeal.
Probably.
Well, good. You put up the money. That would solve some of this too if the attorneys were also financially responsible for some of this stuff.
I'm pretty sure attorneys 2,000 years ago probably drafted something somewhere that basically says they can never be responsible for their clients' fees.
And if you read it while looking in a mirror, the attorney appears before you. So next up, Pangram flagged my own writing as AI. A writer tested the AI detection tool Pangram on her own fi original fiction and was surprised when it flagged parts of her writing as AI generated. Even small human edits caused the results to swing dramatically, sometimes from fully human to fully AI generated. The article argues that AI detection tools are too inconsistent to be used for important decisions, warning that false positives could damage a writer's reputation, cost publishing opportunities, or affect grades and contracts. The author says writers should rely on draft histories, revision notes, and editorial records to demonstrate authorship rather than AI detection scores that can change with trivial edits. I have been talking about this all week.
I mean, we were talking about this earlier in the week, and like I told you guys, like just to play with one of these, I just dropped a block of text that I just written into it, and it said it was 100% human, and it wasn't this particular tester. It was just one that I found on Google. But then I ran through it again, and I let a pro writing aid basically correct my punctuation and dropped it back in there, and I lost almost 40% by doing that because it basically threw in like Oxford commas and stuff I don't typically use. And then I ran through and I accepted the other changes because I tend to leave a lot of words out when I'm writing. Like I'll leave the word and out and things like that. And my sentences are a little shorter and more clipped. So I let it correct everything that it wanted to do. And like that dropped me to like 60% AI, 40% human. And meanwhile, it was all 100% human. But like it's just too easy to for these things to make mistakes.
Does it use history so like it can tell that like
Well,
you
that's what I wondered because I had tried it too with something that I had put in, and then I don't think I use it was and I think it's important to distinguish that it's the probability it was human or AI written,
I
not
know,
the
but that's not how
percentage.
people,
I know,
I
but
know.
people, I'm like, it's a probability. It's not how much of this was AI written, how much is human. It's just a probability. But and then I had changed some things. I think maybe corrected a couple of spelling mistakes, and then it went to like 60% AI generated. And I'm like, it just felt like, well, is it because it's seen this before that it's now saying, oh, this is me? I don't know, but it was really weird.
Or is it in the metadata?
Yeah, there's people who've tested with original stuff that was already perfected. It was already free of errors, and when that was dropped in, invariably it was 100% AI was the
And I'm an
probability.
Oxford comma user and I'm unapologetic
Yeah,
about
me
it. And I
too.
also like
And
my end
dash.
dashes. So, whatever.
They say they're not capturing the text, but like I was reading a story at lunchtime about Claude chats appearing in Google search results, you know, so that text is being captured somehow.
Yeah.
Well, you have to opt out. I think you specifically have to opt out for it not to be used. Otherwise, they're using it, I think. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, the only one that's benefiting from this is the AI companies that you're paying money to.
Exactly. Honestly. This whole, okay, look, AI detection is a scam. I've been saying it all week. It's a scam. It's a scam. The only people that benefit are the AI developers. And what galls me is that these people who are on this witch hunt to find writers who are using AI are feeding that writer's work into AI to find it. Mm-hmm. So they're just basically contributing to the very problem that they claim they're trying to solve. Also, they can tear someone down.
Yeah.
And it just infuriates me.
I saw just before we were coming on, there was this Dagger Mouth study and it's claiming it's AI. And I'm like, I'm not even putting this in the news. I can't read another freaking one of these studies and witch hunt somebody about AI, give money to AI companies. It's just bleh. The most, I don't know if it's interesting, but thing that stood out to me in this article the most is that when she changed a single word, it flipped it from 100% human to 100% AI. And then changing another word flipped it back again. So it's just like, it's so, so unreliable to like ruin someone's career over this to me is just like unconscionable. Yeah. You know?
Kevin, let me ask you a question because you're more familiar with this than I am. Substack has adopted this technology, right? Like how have they actually adopted it? Is it automatically flagging stuff? Do you have to opt in? You have to turn it on?
I think the impression I'm getting, because I haven't looked that closely at it, but the impression I'm getting is that it is something the reader can use at will. So to detect AI so that they can determine whether they want to read that post, which is even more infuriating because I'm like, you know, the false positives are going to lead to a bunch of people, you know. Substack is a platform you can monetize. So that means you could be losing revenue because this thing is out there. Very, very angry about it. Very angry.
Substack to me seems like it was, you know, an up and comer was doing really well. And then all of a sudden they do this, you know, like that. This is the kind of thing that can sink the ship, you know, like people will flee as fast as they possibly can.
Yeah. I'm hoping they're paying attention.
We should send them this podcast. We don't like it, Substack. Knock it off.
Well, yeah, I mean, I do hope that they're seeing, because there's, you know, everyone is talking about this. You know, Dale Roberts, self-publishing with Dale, he has his YouTube channel, and, you know, he did a whole thing about this. We're all livid because it's just so ridiculous. It's like, you can't use AI to hunt for AI. Of course, you're just feeding the machine. It's so obvious that what this is, everyone becomes the product now. The writer and his writing become the data. The person who is using the AI detection becomes part of the data. And it all just benefits some random AI company.
It's also really like an unsettling precedent to say that you as the writer who are putting your words on Substack now actually have no say on whether someone else puts those words into the AI that you never would have agreed to. And I know that, you know, you can't stop who like copies a PDF and puts it into an AI, but it just seems but that's a very right. Yeah, you're encouraging it, and that feels very like dangerous.
We're probably giving up those rights the second we agree to terms of service with Substack. I mean, Facebook has the same thing. There were lawsuits years ago from a woman because her face appeared in an advertisement.
Right, I remember
Then when she traced that back, she realized that the picture came from Facebook, and Facebook basically says if you post a picture to our site, we're allowed to use it for whatever we want. You know, like that kind of stuff is in there. And like, we just blindly sign off on it. All right. What else you got, Kevin?
Agent business models may be shifting. What I fear will happen. Jane Friedman warns the business model for literary agents may be changing as more agents look for additional income through paid editing, consulting, marketing services, referrals, and even publishing their own clients' work. New ethics rules from the Association of American Literary Agents allow these activities As long as financial relationships are disclosed and representation is not directly tied to purchasing services, Friedman believes most established agents will continue to act ethically, but she encourages authors to carefully research agents, ask about their recent book sales, and determine whether their primary business is selling books or selling services.
Here is another thing I hate, Kevin.
Well, it's a red flag, right? Like, if you're about to query agents, if you see that they're out there doing 10 different things aside from being an agent, you know, to me, that's a sign to back away slowly, because they're obviously not making the income they need from being an agent, which means they're probably not that good. That being said, you know, like, the way this market is shifting and the way people are able to publish now, like, the actual client base that they've got access to is shrinking. You know, the money that's coming in from the publishers to pay these people, which the agents earn a percentage of, is getting smaller. You know, there's a lot of things in movement right now.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah. But, you know, I think agents, you know, they need to have other jobs and do other things. Cool. But I don't love that now it's okay for them to keep money paid by clients for paid services, editorial services.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are going to be writers who feel pressured to buy these services in a hope that they're going to get represented or published, right? I don't like it.
It's a distinct conflict of interest, because you're providing all the services, and then there's this one contingency. And even if you are acting ethically, it's still a conflict of interest. It's still an implication that if I'm not using you for my editing or for my, you know, for all these other services, you might just ignore me and not represent me. That's,
well, they basically they become a vanity press, right? Like,
oh,
that's
what
it feels like.
And I don't know. I mean, maybe this is a hot take, but I've actually, I won't query agents who write books in the genre I write. Like, I think that that's a conflict of interest. Like, because there's only so many editors, and if they're going to then be selling their book, you know, I think they can still write, but, like, you know, if they publish in, like, picture books, like, or YA, that's fine. But if, you know, you're writing adult thrillers and they also write adult thrillers, I think that's a little ick. Personally,
I want a one trick pony. I want an agent that does nothing but be an agent.
Well, yeah.
You know, they should be so busy being an agent, they don't have time to do anything else if they're actually good at it. Like that.
Right.
And I don't want the person who's got free time or needs to do something other than being an agent.
I get that.
I mean, I don't begrudge people building little side hustles and things to earn even more money.
But don't do it. Do it for non-clients. Like, separate that. If I edit your work, you can't be a client. Cool.
Well, and I think the requirement should be that they can't do that. They can't have a side hustle that's also in the same industry, because it's still the same conflict of interest. So if they want to do real estate and be a literary agent or something, you know, fine. But I don't necessarily begrudge them. If they're not making enough, it's not necessarily that they're a terrible agent. They just may still be getting their feet under them or whatever. I don't know, man. You're a harsher judge of those folks than I am.
I mean,
Jay.
I'm totally fine with somebody diversifying their income. I think anybody should do that. I don't think, you know, if an agent is looking at their tax return at the end of the year and they're not able to make the bills as an agent, and they're like, well, maybe I can start editing stuff. You know, like, there are plenty of agents out there that do very well as an agent, and they, you know, they make plenty of money because they're very good at it. You know, that's who I want to be with.
I also think, like, if you are an agent and you're editing books, even if you can't have a client for that book, like, it gets a little weird, because now, like, what if you watch that author and, you know, you have a friend and you tell the friend, and then that sells, like, it's going to muddy your opinion, or it tanks. And now you're going to be like, oh, like, I'm not going to pursue those kinds of books. Like, you know, it gets a little, I don't know. I just feel like there's so much
murky, for sure.
Well, the agents that I've worked with that also edit, they've always done it it's basically free. Like, as they're reading the book, they will have, you know, the track changes or whatever on the Word document, and they'll make comments and they'll make edits along the way, just like a traditional editor might. But it's never been something that they charge for. It was just, you know, I'm in the book, I'm reading it right now, I'm going to offer these suggestions later. This is how I'm going to track them for myself so I can present them, you know, to the client. And that was kind of the logic behind it.
Yeah.
I could live with that.
I guess on that, JD, who's up this week?
This week, we've got Josh Winning back on. Josh is the critically acclaimed author of Burn the Negative. He's also the senior film writer at Radio Times. He's back with a new novel called Be Still My Unbeating Heart. It's a cozy vampire mystery set in Italy and releases August 4th. Here he is, Josh Winning.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Yeah, I have been a long admirer of yours since, Burn the Negative. Heads Will Roll, and now a cozy horror romance.
Yeah, this one has all the genres. Whenever I'm trying to describe it to people, I'm like, it's a vampire romance murder mystery with a talking cat. It's just like, I'm being so greedy. I'm just grabbing all the genres and things and just smushing them all together.
I think that's amazing. I mean, why not? Like, that's kind of what... I think we're in a genre smashing era right now, I think.
Yeah, definitely in horror. I think that if you look at sort of like the way that slasher movies have evolved, and slasher fiction as well, actually, but if you look at sort of like mid-2000s, 2010 slasher movies, they suddenly blend things like time travel and body swapping and fake film, like going into a film, like all these different things are being used to help the horror genre sort of still feel fresh, I think. So I'm on board for it. I'm like, give me as many glumming, smushing things as you like.
I tend to towards the horror romance.
Yeah.
Horror romance.
It doesn't roll off the tongue.
Anyway, before we dive into genres and books, we do like to always kind of go back to the beginning and talk about your writer origin story. So how did you get started writing?
I started as a very enthusiastic kid. So I would sort of take books that I really enjoyed or sometimes books that I didn't enjoy as a child, and I would basically sort of like rewrite them with my own spin on them. I did it with movies as well. So one of my favorite films as a kid was Casper, and I wrote a book called Jasper the Friendly Ghost. So sort of very much like a fan as a kid. And I like to think that I was basically trying to play and figure out how a story works, because I just love stories. I love storytelling. I love watching movies. I love reading books. And yeah, I had that creative impulse as well. So I think I took everything that I loved and then tried to do my own thing, even if it was Jasper the Friendly Ghost. You got to start somewhere.
We did change that. It's no longer copyright, right? It's Jasper.
Exactly. That all important different letter at the start of the name. Very important. I think that I just always wanted to write. And so I kind of ended up going into journalism rather than fiction. I did a film degree at university, and there was also writing involved in that. Mm-hmm. And when I graduated, I went to see my lecturer and said to her, I really want to write books, but I don't know where to start. How do you get into that? You know, this is like early 2000s. So the internet wasn't super useful with the advice on that kind of stuff. It wasn't like a common career path for people necessarily. And my lecturer basically gave me the advice of moving into journalism because it was a more secure career path at that time, not so much now, sadly. And so, yeah, I kind of went down the journalist route, but I was tinkering away with fiction in the background, always had this sort of desire to tell stories. And yeah, I just sort of, I'm now in a place where I'm doing both, which is lovely. I'm kind of juggling being a film journalist and writing fiction. And, you know, those two, I think, will always be a big part of my life. So,
I think, like, so hand in hand, too. I mean, like, I think that there's a lot to learn as a writer in film. And I think it's kind of easier sometimes to study film as a new writer, because you can watch a whole story in like 2 hours versus, you know, depending on what your reading speed is, you know, and a book and kind of pulling apart. And I think the beats are a little bit more obvious to learn.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I think that if volume is important, then I think that yeah, you can just watch a ton of movies in the time that it might take you to read a couple of books. And yeah, I think I do agree that I think that the structure of a film is more obvious. And I feel like because we're such a screen-oriented culture now, we're basically sort of consuming screen stories from birth, basically. So I think that you kind of end up having almost like a second, or yeah, you have like an unconscious understanding of how a story works because you have consumed so many stories in your lifetime. And I think that you can kind of train yourself with books about structure and, theme and all those kind of things. But I think that often for me, it's that inbuilt sense of what feels right and what feels wrong that actually guides a story. And I think that does probably come from movies and TV more than books, to be honest.
I definitely agree with that. I like using like I said, like books. They feel it's good to read, and I mean I read a lot, but when I'm thinking about like how to break down beats, I do notice that I will turn to movies. Like kind
Yeah.
of that they're just a little bit more accessible, I think.
And do you find that when you're watching a film, you kind of go, oh, there's the third, the first act, sort of an inciting incident, and then there's the midpoint when it all goes wrong, and there's the all is
Oh,
lost
that's the
moment.
dark night of the soul. Oh, there's the speech in praise
Exactly.
of the villain. Like, yeah, you kind of start to pinpoint it. And then for whatever reason, it's
Yeah.
like that light bulb goes off where it's not, it feels like it's more subtle in books. Like you can find them, but
Yeah.
it's just not quite as obvious.
And it's not quite as rigid, I think, as well. Like, kind of, you can have like a long first act in the book and like a short third act. Yeah. And also, I think it's interesting that it really is like a Western approach to storytelling. Because if you look at sort of East Asian storytelling, particularly Japanese storytelling, they have a completely different arc. There isn't necessarily the hero's journey. They have this sort of approach where it's continuously rising action right until the end, and there's no sort of dark night of the soul. The character doesn't necessarily learn anything by the end of the story. It's such a different approach that I think looking at that really helped me to understand how our approach really is our own, and it is something that we've created. It's not like the only way that stories can be told. It's just the way that we like stories to be told.
I think that's actually really important too, especially as we're talking about genre blending, kind of
Yeah.
understanding that there definitely is a Western approach, but there's not a right approach. Like you can kind of play around a little bit more, which I do think kind of makes genre a lot more fun.
Yeah, and it's more freeing. Totally. It's like you can kind of do whatever you want. It kind of I do find it interesting though that even filmmakers like Charlie Kaufman, who are quite abstract, they do still follow the Western structure of storytelling, even though they kind of pride themselves on not doing that, they do. So it's kind of
It just
inescapable.
sneaks in there a little bit, but
It really
I
does.
know audiences do like what they sort of are familiar with, so that probably is our subconscious, our sneaky subconscious.
Yeah, there's a comfort in it, I think. There's a comfort in knowing generally what you're going to get structurally, I think. And then the story can surprise you within that framework, I think.
Yeah, I agree. So, do you find when you're writing, particularly coming kind of from that film and sort of like understanding that structure innately, that you are like sort of like instinctively pants, or do you outline? Do you kind of plot it out first?
I really, really, really try to outline. Generally, I'll sort of know the beginning, I'll know the middle, and I'll know the end. Especially if it's a murder mystery, I'll pretty much know who the killer is already before I start writing. But when I'm actually plotting, I tend to reach the midpoint and then I just reach capacity, and I can't sort of like plug into the minutiae or like the sort of delicate evolution of character relationships and stuff like that, that I can't really plug into that until I've started writing. So I tend to plot the first half of the book, and I'm aiming to hit that sort of that really exciting midpoint. And once I've done that, I can kind of go, oh, okay, well, this has actually kind of changed a little bit from the outline, and this hasn't changed from the outline, so that I can take stock and think, right, where am I going to go from here? What is the rest of the story before we get to that big reveal at the end? So it's kind of a little bit of both plotting and pantsing.
A planster, if you will.
Yes. That's like a genre mush.
Right, which is very on theme and on brand. I guess let's dive right into that. So you've written dark fantasy, you've written slashers, you've written children's horror, and now we're going into what I would describe as very cozy horror. There's some fantasy to it, but it does definitely feel like a cozy murder mystery in the horror genre. How do you sort of navigate all of that?
With a lot of rewriting. I was commissioned for this book by one editor, Aranya Jain, who I love. She was amazing. She worked on the Head Small Role with me as well. And with this book, we wanted to do something lighter, less sort of like perilous. The stakes were maybe a bit lower. It was definitely more cozy fantasy kind of vibes. And then Aranya left Putnam. And I was very happy for her because she got an amazing new job. So there was no bad blood. We're talking about vampires. And I gained a new editor who she is more of like a horror fan. And she kind of read my first draft of Unbeating Heart that was very, very cozy, very lighthearted. I didn't lean into any of the darkness. So all of Bastian's a vampire in the book, all of his stuff about so like trying to control the anger and trying to control the bloodlust, that wasn't in the first draft. And so my new editor was sort of like, what is this? You know, like it's a vampire and there's murders, but it's like it's really cutesy and cuddly and strange. And I kind of went, yeah, it is. And it was short. It was really short. It was like 45,000 words, which is barely a novella. It's just over a novella length. So once I'd sort of had a chat with Daphne, my new editor, and sort of hashed it out, we kind of agreed that we wanted to keep the light, fun elements, but we wanted to really lean into the darkness as well in order to give Bastian, sort of ground Bastian a little bit more, give him more depth, and give him more of like a struggle to deal with. And so yeah, that's kind of how we ended up with this hopefully artful blend of cozy mystery and sort of more hard-hitting, maybe like social vampire commentary.
Yeah, I think it was really interesting. I love vampires. Let's just get that out there right now. But one of the things I love about it, both in writing and reading it, it's definitely like vampires is such an interesting sandbox to play in. Like there's so much lore that you can sort of like pick and choose. So I'm kind of curious like how you went about picking which little pieces of lore you were going to use, what you were going to sort of put your own little spin on. Like how did Bastion come to be?
It really was fun because I never really thought that I would do vampires for exactly the reason that it's like there are so many vampires in pop culture already. It was like, what can I actually do with this? What's new and what's different?
So much.
And it's sort of like, you know, I love Buffy and Interview with the Vampire and Dracula, you know, all the classics. So I just kind of had to sit down and go, okay, you're writing a vampire book, but what's the analogy here? You know, what is the un I feel like vampires always have to be about something other than vampirism. Probably most monsters do. They have to have something else going on under the surface. So I kind of thought, well, I can only really do this if vampirism is sort of standing in for queerness and it's sort of about exploring queer identity and queer oppression. So that was kind of the starting point for my vampires, was this world where, yes, there are vampire allies, but you know, how honorable is their allyship? You know, there are certain allies who are there for vampires. They are there for their best interests, but there are the allies who are sort of very much like the surface level allies who don't necessarily care. They want to be seen to be caring, but they don't actually really care. So that kind of led into it as well. And then in terms of like the actual qualities of a vampire, so things like he doesn't, so Bastian doesn't have a reflection in the mirror. And what else is that? Like he can't, like if silver touches him, it burns his skin.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of fun to just see what cropped up in the story. And so it was just like in the moment, really, just discovering along the way what the vampires in this world would actually end up constituting. So the moment when Bastian gets arrested for murder and the cuffs go around his wrists, it was a bit like, okay, well, why would he not just break out of them immediately? He's got super strength. He's a vampire. And so the plot went, oh, it's because they're silver and he can't. He's sort of allergic to silver. So it was finding the moments that felt like they needed a vampire rule, I guess.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of the fun part. With vampires, it feels like it's so much more obvious. But I guess in the horror genre in general, like, you know, the big bad does need some vulnerabilities, which when you have, you know, like in a slasher and there's no supernatural elements to it, you know, it's people. We are the vulnerabilities and the flaws. But then, you know, when you do have a supernatural being, you know, it's like, what? Okay, like, is humanity just, we're just doomed? And so you have to kind of give that hope, which I think is really interesting in where those rules come from.
Oh, that's interesting. I guess the hope was important because there was this idea that, yes, you're a vampire, that isn't necessarily a death sentence, you know, socially, culturally. Like you can actually learn to exist within society as a vampire, and you don't necessarily need human blood. You know, Bastian's a vegetarian vampire, so he only drinks like pig's blood, which I know the vegans are going to be upset about that as well, but he's got to drink something.
Right. Know? Yeah. We can't borrow from true blood too much.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't, that was definitely one I was like, no, they can't have true blood because that's a massive thing that's happened already.
Right. I
think the hope thing definitely was inspired by the queer subtext as well, was this idea that, you know, you're a vampire, but you're not necessarily a monster. You can still feel love. There is hope for you. And so I was kind of looking for ways to play around with the queerness in that way as well, I think. And also, the first thing that really came to me for the vampire rules was that that Bastian gets drunk off sunshine. You know, he can go out in the sun if he applies factor 70, but it won't necessarily kill him, but it will make him really, really annoying.
Yeah, that I thought was really fun. I guess like that's what's so fun about discovering new vampires is like every vampire book I've read or watched, I mean, and some don't really, but when they do want to explore vampirism, it is really fun, the little quirks that come out of it. And I thought that one was one. I thought that, I mean, you know, there have been like vegetarian vampires before, but the sun drunk, I thought was really, that was very, those scenes were very fun to read.
Oh, that's amazing. I did have a few edits where people reading the book were kind of saying, Bastian's being really reckless right now. Like, could he not be a little bit worried about what's going on? So I kind of had to find an even ground between being, you know, very silly and drunk on sunshine, but not being so reckless that we don't fear for him. Because if he doesn't fear for his life, then we won't fear for his life either. So that was kind of a tricky line to toe, but yeah, hopefully it worked.
I think that's kind of interesting. We were talking the other week on the show about sort of the importance of why. And, you know, as a journalist, you'll probably appreciate this where, you know, in journalism, you kind of do the who, what, when, where, how, right? Like it's very much that. But in writing, you know, those are like sort of like the tell language. And so you really kind of lean into the why. And I think that that's kind of an interesting thing when you kind of are looking at horror and monsters and supernatural creatures, is because you always have to ask why, you know, like why a vampire, why a talking cat, what, you know, like you kind of have to answer those questions that the reader sort of will go into a book if not consciously asking, kind of unconsciously asking, like, why am I here? What's all this about? So I think that's kind of an important, like, well, why is he acting reckless? Well, because he's drunk.
Yeah, and also, why should I care as well? I think, and leaning into the stuff that is okay, this why is a twist, and this why is just world building, or this why is character backstory. It can be frustrating when you're constantly asking yourself why throughout the book, but I think the why is always an opportunity to add some flesh to the bones and sort of give the reader more information, hopefully, and sort of also like try to mitigate any frustration a reader might be feeling if they are asking a certain why question that you're just not answering.
Yeah, I do notice when I'm reading books, like that is probably the one thing that will sort of like spike my irritation is if I'm reading and I'm just like, why would you do that? Not in the good way, like not in the like, they have to do that because you know where it's going. Not that kind of why, but the really like,
Yeah.
this doesn't make any sense.
And I had a massive one in Heads Will Roll where there was a moment when, clear, like people are dead now, or I think, yeah, one person is dead. And my editor was like, why aren't they just leaving? And I was like, well, because they've looked at the map and it's like 20 miles to civilization. They can't just go into the woods. And she was like, no, I think that we need to have a really concrete reason that is like a horrifying reason. And so that's why when they try to leave the camp, they find these dead bodies on the front steps of the building and a sign saying something like, I own the woods.
Yeah.
And it's like, right, okay, I wouldn't go into the woods either if I'd seen that. So I
Right.
think the whys are always an opportunity to sort of like go harder and go bigger and really put your characters on the spot, I think.
Yeah, just really sort of like dig into that. 'Cause I think, I mean, all fiction explores the human psyche, but I think horror particularly like really likes to get in there, like really get into the guts of it and sort of poke around a lot deeper in a different way than other genres do.
I totally agree. And I think that for me, often with the characters and the why with characters, I go from the start of the book and I try to picture the person they are at the start of the story. And I try to picture something at the end of the story that they would never, ever do. And then the story is them learning why they're behaving the way they are. And why what they're doing is stopping them from growing as people and evolving and changing. And it's sort of like then once they've discovered this and learned this about themselves, that's when they reach the point at the end of the story where they do the thing that they would never have done at the beginning. And it's like a freeing moment of celebration.
Yeah, I think I don't know if you do this, and maybe this is maybe we're gonna find out exactly how weird I am. But ever since I sort of started like writing and kind of digging in and learning character and figuring out, like okay, there's the want, there's the need. My best friend will often we will do that now in real life, and just be like, okay, so what does this person want and what do they need? And you kind of start learning that obviously like. How we are in fiction is how we are in real life, and that you can kind of sort of, I don't want to say psychoanalyze, but you can sort of like identify, like, oh, this is their character arc, so to
Yeah,
speak.
exactly. Yeah. I do do that a lot where I kind of go, okay, I want to stay at home and not leave the house today, but what I need is to go outside because you're going into the crazy place. So it
Yes.
works for everything.
Right, yes, life is the hero's journey. So,
Constantly learning.
what surprised you the most while you were writing this book?
I think it was how much I enjoyed writing romance. I never
Yeah.
ever thought I would write a romance. And with Heads Will Roll, the previous book to this, which is the summer camp slasher, that had sort of a light romance in it where two characters sort of start to come together over the course of the book. And it was an interesting challenge and it didn't super come to me naturally. I think because I was writing to women, so I was very hesitant about, is this consensual? Touching, is it allowed? All this kind of stuff. And my editor was really kind of going, are they thinking about touching each other? Like, are they going to touch each other? Like, what's the feeling going on between them? And so that was a real learning curve in Heads Will Roll. And then with this book, I felt sort of emboldened to really throw myself into it and really go, okay, how does a romance work in a story? And how can I build a story pretty much around the romance? What's my It was quite intimidating at first because I just kind of felt like I'm terrible at romance in real life.
Well,
I
you
don't
wouldn't
like
know it
talking
based on
about,
reading this book.
oh, thank you very much. That's very kind. I basically looked at Han Solo and Princess Leia, that
Perfect.
kind of like grumpy sunshine
Yeah.
dynamic. And I tried to figure out the beats that worked for that romance, why everyone loved it so much, why they still love it now. And I tried to do my own sort of queer version of that. And it was actually really fun. I really enjoyed it. And I've never written like male-male romance before, definitely not as a professional writer. So it was great to really sort of try it out. And it definitely got like spicier and spicier as I was writing it. In the beginning, it was lots of sort of like looks and glowers and sort of thinking about lips and stuff. And then the more I drafted and redrafted, I was like, oh, then he feels like his groin pressing against his leg. And, just like, okay, let's just do this then.
Yeah, I feel like everyone when they go into romance kind of starts in that Pride and Prejudice, right? Like it's very like we're very like prim and proper and like we're only going to look and think and then, once you sort of like you reach a point and you're like, all right, we're doing this.
Completely, yeah. And the original draft of Unbeating Heart, the there were two sex scenes. There was one sort of like around the middle of the second act, and then there was one at the end. And the one at the end was really spicy, and the earlier one wasn't really spicy. It was just sort of like a lot of kissing and touching, and then fade to black kind of situation. And I think it's because I was afraid. I was like, oh, I don't really know if I can write this. Especially if my dad's going to read it, like all these voices are
Oh,
going,
don't think that while you're writing. Oh,
yeah,
God.
oh, horrifying, absolutely horrifying. But then in the next draft, I actually ended up moving the sex scene from the end way up to the earlier one and just sort of copying and pasting it in basically, and didn't really have to change anything because I think I'd figured out by the end of the book how to write a sex scene that was sort of like sexy and raunchy and delivered the spice that readers are probably looking for, but also was rooted in the characters and sort of what are they getting out of this apart from physically, like emotionally, what is actually going on here, and how is this sort of new form of connection between them, helping them both grow wiggly eyebrows as characters.
Pardon the pun.
Yeah, I'm very sorry. I'm very British about all of this. It's all hidden in double entendre.
Well, God, I could keep talking to you for hours. This has been so fun. But we are hitting 30 minutes. So, as we end, we like to ask the same question, which is, what is one piece of advice you would give to new or aspiring writers?
I really try not to give advice because I feel like everyone is so different. But one piece of advice that I often do give, because it works for me, so caveat, this really works for me, is trying to take away the pressure of feeling like every time you sit down with your manuscript that you have to be productive in some kind of quantitative sense. Like I always feel the pressure to sit down and hammer out 1,000 words, and some days I do, and that's great. Some days I don't, and I really beat myself up about it. So I really now sort of support this idea of just checking in. I'm just going to check in. I'm going to go into my manuscript. I'm just going to maybe have a little read of a few paragraphs. And if I add a full stop, if I take out a full stop, if I do that, 5 times over, even do it once, you're actually engaging with your story, and you're sort of keeping it alive. You're you're stopping that disconnect, which means that if you're putting off going back to the laptop because you think you have to write 1,000 words, every time you go back to the laptop after putting it off for 5 days, you're kind of trying to rediscover your ground. You're trying to get back in the flow. So I think it really helps to just check in, no pressure. And if the words come, they come. And if they don't, they don't. And that's fine.
I love that. Check in with your manuscripts. Well, this has been such a delight.
It has. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. So if you like vegan vampires and talking cats and murder and romance, then definitely check out Be Still My Unbeating Heart. Such a great title.
It's a mouthful. It's such a mouthful.
But it's good.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. Well, obviously, I have to start with what's your favorite supernatural creature and why is it a vampire?
Because they are hot and rich. What else do you need in a supernatural?
Yes.
Usually, not always.
Not always. Sometimes they're scary.
That is Anne Rice's fault.
It? I guess it
Vampires were
is.
not hot and rich up until then. No, I take that back. Even the Hammer films, like they tend to cast, pretty decent looking actors to play Dracula back in the day.
I
So
think
maybe it
even in the
started there.
book, like there was a lot of sexual, like Carmilla, Bram Stoker's Dracula.
If you are immortal and you have not made money, there's something wrong with you. Like, come on.
Yeah, I think vampires have always sort of been very sexual and alluring, which is kind of interesting, I think.
The money thing has always been like the catch for me. I think it's I don't know if it's because I worked in finance or what, but like, you take $100, you drop it in a 401k over the next 500 years, it's going to do
Right.
pretty well. So there's zero reason for a vampire to have money problems.
To be poor. That would actually be a pretty funny book, though.
Honestly, like if you think it through, the hardest part in today's world is, you'd have to shift those assets every 60, 70 years to
Right.
somehow move them around or change the names, and like that is getting extremely difficult to do.
I think we have to consider something though. What's the context here? How long have they been immortal? Have they only been immortal for the past 10 years? Because, they may have been
Fair,
really
fair,
bad with
fair.
money.
A
Well,
vampire with a
that's
gambling
true.
problem? A
That is
vampire with a gambling problem would be an amazing story.
that's pretty funny. I'll write that one down for my
Debt
vampire
sucks. That would
sequel.
be the title.
When I did the prequel to Dracula, Bram Stoker in his journal and his actual notes, he had pages and pages of the traits of vampires. And he had researched these things from the time he was 16 until I think he was 43 when he actually started writing Dracula. And he found vampire lore like all around the world. And a lot of the traits were actually the same. But in his notes, his original stuff, like vampires were very much just monsters. They weren't something that were attractive. They were something that fed off of everybody else.
I really liked I Am Legend just because of the scientific approach it took to vampires, like testing garlic and holy water under microscopes and all. I love that, and I always love it when you can take that traditional Bram Stoker type of Dracula vampire and twist it, make something new. The sundrunk thing I think here is brilliant. That sounds
Oh, yeah.
hilarious.
Well, that's like kind of an interesting thing of playing with supernatural creatures, when we were talking about that. Like some people stick like just with like, no, these are the rules and everyone agrees. But, it's actually a lot of fun when you start tinkering with those and playing with them and get them
We got to
some.
come up with some new ways for people to become vampires, though, because we've done the whole virus thing. I really enjoyed Justin Cronin's The Passage and that whole little
Yeah,
series.
those were great.
Yeah.
But it's been done, with the whole virus-caused vampirism. We need to come up with something brand new.
I mean, in real life, they're already kind of playing with it, right? Like we're doing so many different things with genetics. Like like the odds of them actually stumbling into something that creates some weirdness like a vampire or a zombie, it seems like those odds are actually going up, year after year.
What if you were a foreign power who took CRISPR technology and altered the genes of someone to become a super soldier,
You could.
and it
You
basically
just
turned them into a vampire?
turn off the telomere shortening. Like that, I mean,
Yeah.
that's what they're trying to
What
do.
if they were just like self-cloning, like gremlins? They just pop their
There
own vampires out of their stomach. That'd be awesome. Don't get your vampires wet after, what is it, feed them after
Don't
midnight?
feed the vampire
after
after
midnight.
noon.
After midnight.
Don't feed the vampire. That's actually kind of funny. I think it's kind of interesting, even when you bring up gremlins, like, because you think we had talked a little bit about hope and kind of using, you know, these rules as a way of like kind of giving humanity hope and like giving them hope of like good versus evil. Do you,
Yeah.
how do you use hope? Do you use it at all in your writing? Like, does it come out? Is there
Yeah.
no hope?
I strip it all away until the very, very end. It should be totally unattainable to your main
the
character.
My whole tagline is fast-paced, hopeful fiction. And so I try to, you know, leave the reader with a sense of hope by at least the end of the book.
So
I'm
JD,
not
no hope.
Cruel and jaded like JD is.
I'm not saying I don't give them hope, but like it's at the last minute. You're going to find it in that final chapter or something. Up until that point,
yeah.
It's going to seem like the most unobtainable thing in the entire story.
But how do you get your characters to like go out? How do you make sure that they don't give in to just like the nihilism of like, whatever, there's no hope, I'm doomed, so guess I'm going to get drunk.
I don't think there probably are people out there that would react that way. You know, like you throw them in the worst case scenario and they're just going to fold on it. But I think the bulk of the population out there is going to find some way to fight back and keep fighting back until, you know, either it ends them or they win.
Ooh, JD is an ultimate optimist.
Yeah, I think you have to have hope to keep fighting, right? Like everything's going wrong or you're doing things the wrong way. But I think if you had no hope, you would give up. So there has to be some thread of hope
in
there.
Somewhere.
You'd be surprised how long you keep going without any hope at all. It's been like 3 years for me.
Oh.
All right, Kevin, that is a conversation for your therapist, not the podcast.
Oh, like I can afford a therapist.
Oh.
Although this does raise an interesting question. How much does your writing bleed into real life? Let's talk
Wait.
About that.
You know what? I think I know, because when you're talking about that, you and your friend do the what does this
yeah,
person
what do
want
people
and
want?
What do
what do
they
people need?
What do they need?
Yeah.
You know, I had a friend that we used to narrate what people were doing when they would come into the room.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Jenna enters the room. She looks to the right. She looks at me, her eyebrows furrowed, disgust in her eyes. And people would get really annoyed, but we just thought it was hilarious. So I guess like narrating people in real life is super fun. That's all I have
that
to
is
say.
Is really fun.
Yeah.
Anyone at Author Nation will catch Christine and I doing that the entire week. Thank you.
Perfect. Oh, that's going to be our whole Author Nation bit. We're just going to narrate everybody. We'll narrate JD during his talk.
Why don't we do it at Reader Nation? And we'll be like, you can actually type it and we'll project it onto a screen behind us.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, we'll do like all the people that are coming around for books. We'll narrate them.
Yeah.
I love
yeah,
it.
We'll narrate
this.
Them on a big screen so they can read
when
it.
You, as soon as you get their name for the autograph, you,
right.
someone types that up.
Samantha waits in line, ripping her book excitedly.
Yeah. Michelle had JD sign her book. She seemed very excited.
Oh, I just
Kevin is once again napping.
I think we've gone over time, so I guess I'm just going to ask JD who's up next week.
Next week, we've got Lisa Roy coming on. Lisa's graduated from Syracuse University and spent many years as an advertising creative director and copywriter in New York City before turning to fiction. Her second novel, Big and Lily, is about two sisters who discover the best way to find yourself is by basically getting lost. It releases on August 11th. So Lisa Roy.
Yeah, it's going to be great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.